Sunday, 18th of March 2007, the Sydney Harbour Bridge was closed to vehicle traffic to make way for a community event commemorating its 75th anniversary. This oral history compilation tells the story of the organisation of the event and the reaction of the community on that day. It was recorded and edited by Frank Hymans from original interviews with nine persons closely involved in the planning of the event and over 150 members of the public who walked across the bridge. The oral history was commissioned by the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority and is narrated by Caroline McInnes, Senior Curator of the Bridging Sydney Project for the Historic Houses Trust. The opinions expressed in the oral history interviews are those of the individuals concerned and do not necessarily represent in whole or in part the position of the New South Wales Government and its agencies.
What do you feel about today?
Oh, it's great. We're having such a great time. This is a wonderful, wonderful experience.
I think it's fantastic. You just get this like vibe. I don't know what it is. Yes. It's just a great feeling. Fantastic.
It's history.
Like goosebumps. Got goosebumps.
Yeah, I was almost about to cry just before. It was a real big knot in my throat.
Oh, it's a historic moment. It happens only once in a lifetime, really. My daughter's just done a headstand. We took photographs. She'd be the first person to do the headstand on the Harbour Bridge.
We're from Nottingham, and we're on holiday here, and this has been the most wonderful experience I can tell you about.
It's really good, yeah. Really? I mean, we will never see it again in our lifetime, and I suppose we shall ever walk the bridge, and thanks to Sydney for letting us cross it. How's that?
We're really thrilled to have done it.
Thrilled to bits we are. Yes.
We need another bridge like this across the Bass Strait because I live in Tasmania. So.
And we're also going to have to tell them at Trent Bridge in Nottingham where we come from. We want a celebration like this.
I think the bridge had the single greatest impact on Sydney, on the way Sydney operates, because it is linked to a wider infrastructure and because of the subsequent dominance of the motor car. It linked the north and the south with infrastructure. It linked the two halves of the city symbolically. It enabled the effective opening up of the North Shore that had been really underpopulated at that time comparative to the southern districts. It changed the way we used the city with the building of the underground railway, the way people accessed and came in and out of the city.
Is this the first time you've walked across the bridge, sir?
No, 25 years ago with children in tow, or child in tow.
And how do you feel today?
Oh, it's good. It's good to see a nation at peace with itself.
Happy birthday, Sydney Harbour.
The Sydney Harbour Bridge's anniversary event utilised much of the research undertaken for the Bridging Sydney exhibition at the Museum of Sydney. I began work on the project in 2001.
What was your vision for the exhibition? How did you want it to treat it?
The concept was really to bring together the broader story, to let the objects, the archive, the voices and the stories from the past speak. It was a joy to meet descendants of bridge workers and bridge engineers and to feel the connectedness and the passion and the ongoing resonance that the bridge had within the community, not just a contemporary association, but a deep-seated, long-rooted historic association through, you know, memory and family and personal experience. So we started delving into the material, the archive, and as I delved into it, I mean, I was blown away too at the richness of the subject matter, the long planning history behind the bridge, the amount of time that it had taken, the vigorous debates about its scale, its height, its location, the various interests that inputted into that. You know, it's been there. We use it every day. It's a utilitarian icon. We see it on New Year's Eve. People climb it, walk it, drive it, get stuck in traffic, frustrated with it. But, you know, it's an appropriate point in time before every last living memory of the opening and some of the construction had disappeared to capture that history as best we could. We were very keen to put together an exhibition that not only incorporated some of the art, but also told the planning and the engineering and the people's stories behind the bridge. And I think we did that quite successfully, because the next bit of the jigsaw puzzle we brought on the RTA, we said they're the current owners and managers of the bridge, of course, and we went to them, I think, 3.5-4 years out from the 75th, and they're a bit blown away that anyone was thinking about the 75th anniversary quite so far out.
How many images and photographs were available to you to choose from, and on what basis were they chosen?
Well, there is the most amazing record of the bridge construction. JJC Bradfield was very hardworking, meticulous, and I think we owe a great deal to him in the documentation of the bridge. So there are 2,500-3,000 black and white photographs beautifully taken by the public works photographers that are pasted into large leather-bound volumes, 12 or 13, I think, that live in state records. And they are fantastic.
Tell me something about John Bradfield. What struck you about him? What sort of a man was he?
John Bradfield was a very brilliant man. He was an engineer, but he had a knowledge of Greek and Latin and the arts and literature. You read his papers and the way he writes is eloquent, informed, lateral. It includes references to all sorts of things. He's very persuasive, very dedicated. He's positioned very well to carry the bridge project through. I mean, there's huge commitment and passion to achieve this infrastructure for Sydney. At that time, they were still looking at split road and tunnel systems, and he was in the ideal position to argue for a single system to carry road and rail as a high-level bridge, not as a split system. He was a great politician. He was his own great spin doctor. He was the chief bridge engineer and responsible for City Transit.
My name's John Fraser, and I was born in Melbourne on the 29th of February 1932, and 20 days later, this great icon was opened on the 19th of March. So that's my link in that sense of the word. But being a structural engineer, I've always had an interest in history, and one of the things I soon found out is it's not the item, which might be this bridge, of course, but it's all the other part of the story, the technology, the personalities, the economics, the political aspects, I mean, Jack Lang and all that, it's all part of the story.
Jack Lang, the Premier of New South Wales at the time, was a supporter of Bradfield, and his endorsement was vital to the success of the project.
You had to have a Premier that was confident in building it, and John Lang was the man. They built it. It was only through his perseverance and getting funds where he could that the bridge was built. Many wanted to put it off and keep putting it off, but we had to have a bridge, and we got it today. And thank God that I'm at 85, I was able to walk it again.
I think Lang and Bradfield had a respectful regard for each other and worked well together. Lang, to his credit, left Bradfield alone to manage the project with his expertise. He trusted him to deliver, and Bradfield respected Lang for his support for the vision for the project. Bradfield certainly deserves the credit he has had, because without him, one wonders whether we would have ever had a bridge, you know, in that location, because it took massive determination and ability to stay on course through changing political leaders, through different economic times, through World War, you know, to keep that vision alive and to push for it.
My name is James Bradfield Moody, and I live in Erskineville. My great-grandmother was Caroline Bradfield, who married Edward Brandon Savage Moody, and that's where the Bradfield line comes in.
Do you have any memories of this bridge? What are your early memories of being here?
When I first came to Sydney, we used to drive over the bridge a lot, just because I loved it, you know. It was a wonderful piece of engineering. So my first memory is actually driving across the bridge and then back again for no reason.
And so what sort of emotions are you feeling today about walking across here?
Oh, I think pride, not just for Bradfield, but I guess for all of Australia, for Sydney. When you think that we built an eight-lane highway 75 years ago, when really I think it was not even being imagined that we'd ever need eight lanes, to do that is quite an amazing feat, and to do it with the technology they had in those days was really extraordinary.
Was he a bit obsessive about getting his vision done of the bridge, would you say?
Perhaps obsessive, but also adaptable. You know, it was only at the very last minute that the bridge changed to become the arch bridge that we know today. Right up until 1921, when the contract was written, it was actually for a cantilever structure. So the huge document that was actually printed, we were that close to having a cantilever bridge. When he went overseas in 1921-22 as part of the tender process, the overseas firms actually spoke to him about the arch proposal and the benefits of it. He did his own calculations and worked out that there was in fact less steel involved in the arch proposal, therefore it was cost effective. So at the last minute, he wired back from overseas to the government and said, please add three words into the act, and that is a cantilever or an arch. And that was the moment in time when history changed. We ended up with the arch bridge.
My name's Peter Roper. I'm here today with our whole family of descendants from my great-uncle, William Hugh Roper. My great-uncle was the head engineer for the approaches north and south sides of the bridge, and he was probably a right-hand man for Dr. Bradfield during the construction time. From my understanding, he was a very bright man, Uncle William, and basically he was regarded as a problem solver by Bradfield as well, and he was unfortunately a quiet fellow who never got much recognition for the type of work that he did do, considering he was up against the Bradfield name, I suppose.
On the 27th of February 1924, the firm of Dorman Long & Co. of North Yorkshire won the tender to construct the bridge, and work began on the preparations for the approaches. Construction progressed rapidly, and the site was filled with men working at dangerous heights above the harbour as the two halves of the arch reached towards each other.
And there were 16 people killed in the construction. But when you consider the conditions that they worked, and you see some of the photographs, and there was no occupational health and safety. The guys are up there with nothing attached to them, no ropes, no harnesses or anything, working away. And I've seen photographs about, it must be halfway up the arch. And if you look at the cross members, the angles that they're at, and the guys are out on these really funny angles. It's amazing there weren't more killed, really.
The risks were great. I don't know how they even built it. I mean, it was depression, no safety nets, literally clinging with your fingers and driving hot rivets into every bit of steel. Amazing. I wouldn't even be game to go up the top today. And these men practically lived up there. Now, a lot of them were World War I blokes, and the war had cost a lot of money. So how they found it to build the bridge, thank God somebody did.
The New South Wales Premier's Department was the lead government agency to prepare for the 75th anniversary community event. Rachel Herford is the Director of Special Event Management.
I work in a team that delivers the events. I work very closely with a team who works to coordinate the different government agencies' response to and support of major events, whether they be delivered by us or delivered by an external event organiser or agency. And there are some quite established mechanisms for doing that, which were developed in the lead up to the millennium and then certainly proved extremely worthy over the Olympics and have been maintained. So every month there's a Central Sydney Operations Group meeting. A lot of the operational representatives of whether they be the trains or buses or health or police, those sorts of people, come together on a regular basis to discuss events in, I think it was the 20th of June, 2006, we pulled together a group of people from across, I guess, relevant government agencies, and we gave them some homework to do beforehand. We asked them to send that in, but essentially we were seeking from them, from wearing their hat or their agency's hat, what was important to them that the 75th celebration should deliver. And that group of people included Tourism New South Wales, the Ministry for the Arts, the Roads and Traffic Authority. We had the City of Sydney there, the Sydney Harbour Foreshore Authority, the Royal Botanic Gardens. We had the police, importantly. Now, they kind of didn't fit with the mix of people in the room who were more so about ideas and delivery, but that was important at the onset to have them on side and involved so that there was a sense of, I guess, ownership and understanding from the very beginning. I think what was certainly agreed there and what we put up was that this was a celebration. It was about participation in the community. It was to try and do something unique that had never been done before, that set a benchmark, an event that would clearly demonstrate Sydney's ability to create and deliver major events, both nationally and internationally on that world stage. If this was about the bridge and about its 75 years, we had a role to educate so that people came away from that whole experience knowing a little bit more, understanding the story of the bridge, and that the bridge was highlighted in its purest, truest form in terms of its structure, but also the people that were responsible in designing and building it.
One of the most important planning issues was transport and traffic management for the event. Bill Lawson is Executive Manager, Major Events at the RTA.
We had a traffic and transport working group which met no fewer than 10 times to cover off on all of the issues. And that was only one of the working groups. There were at least 6 to 8 of those groups, another one being communications. Not only communications within the organisations, but the message to the public. What were the expectations of the public and how do we actually manage that? So a number of things need to be brought together.
For the RTA, the event generated major road closures and diversions. Dennis Wheeler is the RTA's Transport Operations Planning Manager.
Any event, we look at how we manage the non-event community, because what will make your event successful is the non-event community. The people coming to the event, they're already happy. They know what they're doing. They're going to have a great time. They don't mind the road closures. The road closures are there for them. But it's that non-event community. It's a very large number. They can make or break your event. And certainly in the case of the Harbour Bridge, we're talking potentially something like 6,000 to 7,000 vehicles per hour normally use the Sydney Harbour Bridge and the Sydney Harbour Tunnel. But that has a fairly limited capacity, around about 4,000 vehicles per hour is sort of the optimum number of vehicles. And if we have too many vehicles trying to fit into the funnel, if you like, that would have generated a large amount of delays for those people perhaps trying to access the Harbour Tunnel, going to the airport.
So if you had a delay, let's say, on the freeway going into the Sydney Harbour Tunnel for an hour or so, how many cars would that generate in a queue? How long would the queue be?
Well, approximately 170 vehicles is equivalent to about 1 kilometre. So in the case of 6,000 vehicles, we've got about 2,000 vehicles that aren't going to get through in that hour. That gives us about a 10-kilometre single-line traffic queue. So that's certainly some considerable delay. And that would also generate problems on the rest of the arterial network. So we try and avoid that.
Rachel Herford adds,
for the actual day itself, we produce an event manual, or some might call it an operations manual, which has, I guess, the basis of everything in it you could possibly need to answer a question or give direction or have a sense. So extremely comprehensive contact lists, extremely comprehensive but very simple point form procedures. So what to do if, like, you know, you've found a lost child or you've found lost property or there's an issue with crowds or how to start the walk. So quite detailed procedural stuff specific to areas and then general across the whole event. Run sheets, so for each key component of the event, starting with the official ceremony in the morning, the walk, the plaque ceremony, each little moment, quite detailed run schedules and information about who was responsible for which bit. maps, reporting forms if there was any sort of incident, details of radio channels. There was a very large two-way radio network operating across the city for the event, who was on which channel and how they operated. They reported back to our central control room, which was based in North Sydney, just near Milsons Point Station. So, yeah, look, it gave a sense of how that all fitted together. Clearly then the minute detail that was specific to very particular roles was then with those people and didn't need to be in that document. That document went to every person working on the event, either in a hard copy or electronically, and to every government agency, an agency contact who was involved in the event. And then a separate manual was produced for volunteers, which was much simpler and very specific to their roles and how they fitted into the bigger picture.
What did you think of this particular event and what the challenges would be?
Yeah, well, certainly the challenge would have been certainly providing for a safe event, numbers of people, how they were going to actually be invited, what was the creative that was actually going to be around the event. Because the creative, meaning the sort of, you know, whether it was the entertainment or some bridge effect or fireworks or whatever it might be, all of that, of course, makes the event longer, makes the clean-up perhaps a bit longer. If we have fireworks on the bridge, there's normally always a clean-up campaign after it with street sweepers and the like, which, of course, delays the opening. So I guess the major thing was about the number of people. What was the style of the event? What were we going to do on the day? Were they going to be harbour events like waterborne events? How were they going to impact on vantage points around the harbour, attracting people? But then, of course, the focus was really on the bridge itself and how we're going to manage people and how they're going to walk across the bridge.
The event organisers were well aware of the lessons learnt from previous birthday celebrations. Bill Lawson reflects.
In 1992, when they had the 60th anniversary of the bridge, it was just prior to our bid for the Games as well. They said, oh, why not just have people come to the bridge? Yeah, good idea. Except they allowed people to come from the north and come from the south, and they put a band in the middle. And that, of course, stopped people. We obviously learnt from that particular event and saw the photos and knew that we weren't going to have a band in the middle. We needed to have a clean space for people actually to walk through.
The next step was to determine the creative elements that would make up the day's programme. Noel Staunton was one of the executive producers of the event.
The first thing we had to do was put a creative team together, which we did. We hired a gentleman called Tony Asnes, who is a young creative designer who's come from the theatre world but has done a lot of major events around Sydney and in Melbourne. We also brought Elena Katz-Chernin, who is an Australian composer, because we felt music was a very important part of the idea, that people not only see the bridge, but they feel the bridge and have some music. And also sound is a very important part of today's environment.
During the creative brainstorming sessions, many ideas were proposed. Majid El-Khatib, RailCorp's manager of special events, was one of the participants.
Look, they had all those lavish ideas and wanted to move thousands and thousands of people over the bridge. I can say it now. There was a secret meeting, if you say secret, meeting with some of the producers. They came to my office and said, oh, look, we've got an idea, Majid. We're just seeing if you're interested. And I thought, okay. And they were very creative. You can't give them that. They wanted to put steam trains over the bridge. They wanted to put their lights on the back of steam trains. And they just had this whole sort of idea. And I said, well, that'll be a bit hard if you want to move X amount of people. You know, we're talking then 150,000 plus people. It's not just easy to stop a train plan and bring on a steam train sort of thing.
Catherine Parker is RTA Communications Services Manager.
There was some discussion about having an iconic Australian person who would create a concert on the bridge. Someone either seriously or jokingly suggested Kylie Minogue should do a concert off the bridge. There was any number of, you know, should there be a cavalcade of floats across the bridge of, you know, people who can do it as a parade across the bridge, and so then it is a spectacle.
There were an enormous amount of ideas, but with every idea we had to think of the practicality of each idea. And in today's time, one has to be very careful of public responsibility and crowds and crowd flow, etc.
Rachel Herford clarifies.
We had a plan for a rather enormous sound and light show, which in the end we didn't have the budget to be able to deliver that in its entirety and chose to step back from that. That was going to involve live performers and live performance sort of on the bridge and off the sides of the bridge and people arriving by helicopter and all sorts of things. Then there was a concept, and this is all documented in one of our original concept books that went to Treasury, for a procession of canoes that were typical of the Gadigal people, the traditional landowners, who were very water-based people and fished and canoed, and they always had a small fire burning in the end of the canoe. Certainly one of our visions was to try and send up the harbour hundreds and hundreds of canoes with flame to sort of pass under the bridge at sunset in time with the smoking ceremony, which would have been beautiful. And we still think we could have done it, but it really came down to money and how to make that all work.
The idea of 500 canoes coming up the harbour with flame would have been a spectacular visual moment. Unfortunately, because of the currents and things of the harbour, all the canoes would have to be motorised, and it was all very complicated and turned out to be deeply expensive. So that idea had to be ditched. Another one we had, when I worked at the Ring Cycle, I did a lot of work with fire and water. With the Adelaide University, and they've found a way of converting water into fire. We had one idea of having 75 fountains of fire coming out, water coming out of the harbour that would then turn into fire to represent the candles. Unfortunately, that was $1 million a moment for every candle, and we just did not have that budget. But a great technological moment. We had rock groups on top of the bridge, we had rock groups under the bridge, and we had rock groups in the middle of the bridge. They all had to go. But while all those ideas were fantastic and expensive, we still came back to the very essence of what we wanted to do, and that was really to celebrate the bridge. We didn't want fireworks. We didn't want to put a badge on the bridge, like a coat hanger or something. We just wanted to say, this is the bridge, and let the bridge speak for itself.
We created a soundscape that lined the bridge. We worked closely with the ABC. So as people crossed the bridge, they actually, I guess, experienced an audio journey. They went through the eight decades of the bridge's life, starting in 1932, and they heard a mix of sort of music, news bites, and grabs. So definitely a first. We engaged a sound engineer, designer, who's quite brilliant technically. He, I guess, designed the system to be positioned that would achieve you being able to walk into a decade and walk out of a decade and then into another without them overlapping from an audio point of view. We referred to them as sound pods. So you walk through from the overture through to the sound chimes at the end.
The economic crisis through which we have been passing has left its mark. But I believe that the Australian people have won to a position which is the envy of the world.
Here is the Prime Minister of Australia, the Right Honourable R.G. Menzies.
Fellow Australians, it is my melancholy duty to inform you officially that in consequence of a persistence by Germany in her invasion of Poland, Great Britain has declared war upon her, and that as a result, Australia is also at war.
Melbourne, November the 22nd, 1956.
We await the arrival of the Olympic flame, the symbolic emblem of true sportsmanship.
And it's to the line, and it'll be Fraser first, Trapp second, Fraser first, Trapp second. Oh, a blanket finish for third. Dawn Fraser has beaten Lorraine Trapp by only inches.
This is the ABC from 3AR Melbourne regional and shortwave stations.
As we listen to some of the music from and some of the old radio shows and like Blue Hills, and think to ourselves, the young people here wouldn't know what that was all about. But yeah, we're finding it nostalgic. And my wife, this is the thing she really wanted to do, is to come here and see this. So
Sydney's
she's
my
the most
town. I love it. I just love Sydney.
How many were in the creative or design staging crews?
There were probably five people. Core, our creative director, executive producers and producer, myself in the initial stages. Then I guess supporting that team was a director of production who had three senior people who looked at the logistical production elements, and then underneath all of those people then a whole range of extras. Day to day in the office, by the time the event was delivered, I think I said before there were about 50, 55 people in the office, a number of then people outside full time on the day itself and the night before. So we worked sort of over the day and all night the night before the event, and then all half the next night, about 120 crew involved in setting up and pulling down, and then 550 volunteers.
Now, what was unique about this particular event compared to other bridge closures that you might have had in the past?
For this event to actually happen, all the infrastructure that was required to go in, from safety fencing through to light show displays to sound trucks, it actually required a complete bridge closure for approximately 18 hours. But on top of that, we required a lot of lane closures, lanes 1 and 2 and lanes 7 and 8. And they actually started about 11 o'clock the night before on the Saturday night, and then continued through till about 5 a.m. the next morning.
On the 18th of March, Dennis Wheeler's day began early.
My day probably started around about 2:30 a.m. The alarm went off. I was actually sleeping in another room because my wife didn't really want to be disturbed at that hour of the morning. So anyway, off in the vehicle a little bit later on. Our closures actually started with some of the access ramps from about 3:45 a.m. and we were looking at having the Harbour Bridge fully closed by 4:30 a.m. Probably around about 4 o'clock, we had a large number of infrastructure trucks all queued up on the approaches to the Harbour Bridge, waiting for the bridge to close. These were carrying things like the pedestrian crowd control barriers, the plastic water-filled barriers, and numerous other bits and pieces of infrastructure. So once the bridge was closed, it basically became a construction area. There was vehicle and people moving in. It was controlled chaos, if you like. So we were involved primarily with all the barricading, providing all the safety infrastructure. And Premier's department were involved in bringing in all the infrastructure for the actual event. Included things such as the giant wind chimes at the southern end of the Harbour Bridge. That was a feat in itself to get up all those hundreds of wind chime tubes. There was a large number of vehicles coming in with all the sound equipment on it. And there was also about five trucks that came in to provide a portable temporary stage near the northern pylons where the ceremony and all the speeches took place.
Sydney writer and broadcaster John Doyle was the master of ceremonies.
The moment has come to be very official. It's the moment we've been waiting for, the official ceremony to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the Sydney Harbour Bridge. And what a great monument to 20th century optimism it is. 16 men died during its construction, and later this morning the Premier will unveil a new plaque in Dawes Point Park as a memorial to those men who not only risked, but in 16 instances, lost their lives. For the traditional welcome to country, please welcome Auntie Sylvia Scott, Matthew Doyle, who was positioned quite precariously on the gantry behind us in the middle there on didgeridoo, Adam Goods and Zane Walford. If you could welcome them, please.
Now let me introduce Auntie Sylvia to welcome you to country. Thank you. I can remember being very young and the Sydney Harbour Bridge was just being finished, and I remember clearly hearing about the big festivities that were taking place. Aboriginal people were not even citizens then. Our times have changed. On behalf of the Gadigal people and the Cammeraygal people, I welcome you to country and wish you a safe and happy journey across this bridge and their lands and waters. Thank you.
The Our Bridge Choir was led by Australian singer Jessica Malboy.
Now may I introduce the Honourable Maurice Yemmer, MP, the Premier of New South Wales.
When the Sydney Harbour Bridge was declared open for traffic on March 19, 1932, the honour went to the Premier, Jack Lang, and the Governor, Sir Philip Game, was left to preside, which seemed to mean just standing there, fidgeting awkwardly in his strange feathered cap. As it turned out, Francis de Groot would steal the show from both of them. And 2 months later, the very same governor bundled Lang out of office. It is appropriate that 75 years later, amid a hard-fought election campaign, that centre stage on this historic occasion should belong to our governor. Because unlike 1932, the role of governor is now authentically an Australian office, chosen from among us, chosen to reflect us, and none of them has been finer than our 37th Governor. She's as wise and prudent as the monarch she represents, as warm and decent as the people she serves, and as gracious as the bridge I now ask her to rededicate and open for this birthday walk. Ladies and gentlemen, please honour and welcome the Governor of New South Wales, Her Excellency, Professor Marie Bashir.
Thank you, Mr. Premier. The Sydney Harbour Bridge will never date, never grow old. A structure of its time has become a structure for all time. The bridge from north to south is also a bridge to our better selves, a place of journeys and homecomings, where art meets engineering and a nation shows the world what it could do. On this day of celebration and remembrance, I honour the place of this bridge in the Australian imagination. I rededicate it to the people. And I ask you to join me in reaffirming with your footsteps the love and esteem in which we hold this greatest of civic blessings, our landmark, our achievement, our conquest, our bridge. Thank you.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, you're about to hear the very first public performance of the Our Bridge Overture, composed by the distinguished Australian composer Elena Katz-Chernin. It was recorded by the Sydney Symphony Orchestra and conducted by Simon Kenway, especially for this occasion. ¶¶ Now, I believe the governor will be taking the scissors very shortly, I suspect in her right hand, and will be attempting to cut through this ribbon. The cutting has almost begun. It has begun. There is no sign of a mad horseman. The cutting has been completed.
Many years ago, my mother was a girl working at Mark Foy's on the ribbon counter, and she was the sales girl who sold the ribbon that was stretched across the bridge for the original opening. And in her scrapbook, we have a tiny little piece of that ribbon.
Really?
It's very exciting. Yeah, so in memory of my mum, I'm walking today. Yep. Yeah, and she never walked across this bridge. Even the day it was opened in 1932, she never walked across it.
I've got to say, I thought it was quite a moving experience. And is that the Bridge Symphony that you're playing? I thought it was marvellous.
I'm Richard Felix from Melbourne.
Right.
All the way up here for this.
So what sort of emotions are going through you at the moment?
Bubbly. Feel good. I'm usually afraid of crowds, but I feel really good.
How do you feel about doing this walk today?
It's just an awesome experience, just to be walking actually on the bridge rather than driving. It's just, and the atmosphere is just beautiful. Everyone's just so happy and just, it is a historical moment, I guess.
My name is Santino Yombolwek. I came from Sudan. It is really very exciting. I am happy also to be a part of that story. What is impressing is that when this bridge was built 75 years ago, there were no computers, and I was wondering how it had been done. You know, the technology, how did they calculate it at that time? That was, you know, my surprise.
It's worked beautifully, very well organized. 100%.
The New South Wales Minister for Roads and Minister for Commerce, the Honourable Eric Ruzendahl, MLC, was there.
Well, I think it'll be a great day of community spirit, celebration of an Australian icon, and it's going to be a fantastic day.
Do you have any personal memories of the bridge yourself, anything connected with the bridge?
Well, I've got a lot of memories of the bridge, but I think the one that stands out is my brother and I always fighting over who would hand over the 20-cent toll whenever we crossed the bridge to visit my grandparents. And those days have changed since it was 20 cents, but it's certainly something I always remember.
They used to have ads on the bridge that used to flash. And I can remember one, I think, was Smoke Capstan, the Empire's favourite cigarette. I don't think you'd put an ad for cigarettes these days, would you?
We're from the US, but we live here in Sydney now. Australia seems to be very good at this kind of stuff. Better than the US, I think. It's my impression.
How does this bridge compare with your Brooklyn Bridge, say?
Ask her.
Well, the Brooklyn Bridge is quite an extraordinary piece of work. It doesn't quite have the sense of celebration, though, that this bridge has. And I think with the icon status of the combination of the harbor, the bridge, and the opera house, that I don't think there's anywhere else in the world that kind of matches that. But no, there's no city. I've lived in many, many major cities, and there's no city that puts on parties and celebrations better than Sydney does. And we've committed to doing the bridge walk again in 25 years, even if I'm one of these little ladies with a cane. Jasmine and I are going to do it again.
Would you like to say a few words to us?
Well, nothing except that I'm older than the bridge, thank you. My 76th birthday is next week.
No, well, you don't remember the opening, of course, of the bridge then.
No, I don't, no. I was still in short pants, so... Nappies.
So what do you feel about the bridge?
It's wonderful.
Have you many occasions?
I put on my bowler hat just in case any of your colonial workmen might have dropped a rivet on my head.
I don't think there'll be any more rivets falling now.
Don't you think? Oh, well, I'm glad to hear it.
Now, what does it mean to you, this bridge?
Not a lot, I have to admit. I hear that you frequently get stuck on it.
You mean it doesn't match up the bridges in the old country?
It's a nice little young bridge.
You'll have a bridge probably 1,000 years old in the London Tower Bridge, isn't
That's
it?
That's right, yes.
So do you think our bridge can compare to your bridge?
Well, it's not bad for beginners.
I walk across the bridge to work. It takes me about an hour. I've seen some fantastic things during that time. Sometimes I see the different moods in the harbour. Sometimes it's a Monet day, just a soft light. Other times it's bright and the water's sparkling, and that's wonderful as well. See lots of different people walking across. There are tourists that are probably on a different time scale to us. They probably think it's afternoon when it's early morning sort of thing. And I see joggers, sometimes see some Navy people. I think they run in their swimming costumes across and their speedos. It's terrific. There's always a lot of fun going across the bridge.
I've come in quite early in the morning and just sat at the end of the Opera House watching the bridge, watching the colours change on it as the sun comes up. And it's really the heart of the city. There wouldn't really be, I guess, a sense of civic pride as much if we didn't have the bridge.
It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. I mean, just look at it. Have you ever seen anything like that? I've never seen anything as beautiful as that. Standing here and just looking up there is just perfect.
I think the bridge is about a connection with Sydney, with the city, with the people. I guess it was the eye and lung, 1932, kept a lot of people fed. It's a great thing.
Oh, wonderful. Nowhere else in the world would you get a free hat, you know. With a great chance for them to clean up on the hats, but no, 200,000 hats, fantastic. Only in Sydney in Australia.
I feel like I'm part of something huge, especially when you see all the hats.
It's fun because when you look at the other side of the bridge, there's like lots of green hats and sea of people in green hats. It's funny.
Now, what was the idea behind handing out caps?
Probably two key reasons. One, I guess, from a memento sense, giving those who walked across the bridge something commemorative. In 1932, you were able to post postcards and letters from the bridge that were stamped. There were also certificates. We were looking for something, I guess, a little different. We handed out nearly 200,000 caps. The caps themselves were problematic and a challenge from the very beginning to the very bitter end, from the moment that they were thought of to designing them, the time frame we had. They came from China. There was no other option. We actually sent two people there, and in the space of 3 days, they went to meet with a manufacturer. It turned out they couldn't do it, had to find someone else, test samples, you name it. And, you know, we're expecting them to come back just before New Year with a cap and be able to say, well, this is what it's going to look like, but we weren't quite at that point yet. So it actually took to a few more weeks into January to get to that point, and to virtually the cutoff of knowing we had to go into production to get them on a ship to get them here in time. So extremely tenuous to get there, and then to actually get agreement as to how they would be handed out. There was quite a lot of nervousness from the RTA in particular, that we were going to create real crowd problems.
Bill Lawson adds,
one of the most difficult things was actually addressing the issue of hat distributions. Naturally, the throughput of people on a bridge, if they're just going to walk and perhaps even look at the bridge, and that's what the day was about, there's a certain capacity of the bridge and a certain safe crowd size in terms of how they actually behave. Once you introduce a collection point, if you like, well, then, of course, discounts the throughput. And then we end up with perhaps even a queuing of people, which could lead to queuing back into the streets close to the stations where people are trying to get out of trains. That means people can't get off trains onto platforms. One thing leads to another. So I was a bit concerned about how the hat distribution was going to take place.
Dennis Wheeler elaborates.
We did a lot of modelling on distribution of hats. The City Rail timetable was actually operating at 12 trains per hour, which is one train every 5 minutes, and that's in both directions. So we're now talking potentially one train every 2.5 minutes, with anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500 people per train.
When you do the simple maths, it turned out the hats had to be handed out at the rate of 6 hats per second every second, which is, when you think about it, it's quite a feat, and you need many, many people to actually do that. They can't do it for 10 hours, so you've got to have rosters and you've got to have a number of people. But importantly, you've got to have the supply of hats nearby. And that's a concern as well, because how do you just keep up the supply of hats at that rate? The modellers that we had as consultants, and did a rather great job, let me say, they provided information on how a transaction would actually delay the queue. And then we knew from that particular modelling that having four lines of distributions wasn't going to satisfy the demand that we had at the rate we were delivering people. Then looked at some alternatives and came up with, instead of four transaction lines, making it into seven transaction lines. And we felt more comfortable with that. That was probably going to be our best opportunity to actually satisfy the crowd.
So how do you look back at the hats episode? Do you think it was successful?
It was certainly successful. It did actually provide a great opportunity for people to collect a hat at the scene. They became part of the bridge family, if you like, by all putting on a hat. There was this great camaraderie of all people wearing a hat. They all looked great. They all had some other mission to be there about wearing the hat across the bridge. But the ones that did work the best, I think, were the ones, the night hats, that started to be handed out at 7 p.m. They had a light on them and very, very effective, particularly as night fell. Twilight hours came and it was verging on dark, and all those little bobbing lights like glowworms were walking across the bridge. It was terrific. And interestingly, with hours, we're told, of when the bridge walk finished, that hats were being sold on eBay for those who didn't actually get a hat. So whether they made any money, I don't know.
To publicise and deal with public inquiries about the event, a website was launched. Noel Staunton explains.
First of all, we did was to set up a website, because that's the first place people go to, and it's also the easiest place to control the information that goes out. And of course, the other major decision we made was the decision about registration. You had to register on the net. We also had telephone registration and fax registration, but we wanted to use the whole net as a method of dealing with this. And that we did, and it was interesting, the registrations moved much quicker than we'd actually anticipated, but we were very pleased. So the internet was a major tool in that way. And we had some very funny emails, people who wanted to come from Queensland, and they wanted to have a picnic on the bridge, and they wouldn't hold it up for too long. And we had to explain to them that people had to keep walking, otherwise we'd end up with enormous traffic problems. So the net was an amazing tool for these type of events.
The support of the media to publicise the event was crucial. Brad Turner is the manager of the Sydney Harbour Bridge Alliance.
We had almost endless media interest in the last fortnight in particular. You know, some really quirky questions and odd stories, and a lot of the usual cliche stuff about the sandstone, which is actually granite in the pylons, and De Groot's sword and all those sorts of things. It was just so varied. We had people from Japanese television want to talk about it. We had, yeah, as I say, almost endless. Everybody wanted to come down and interview the current version of Paul Hogan, assuming that there are just like a factory that we don't actually maintain the bridge. We just build new little Paul Hogans every 10 years just to keep the media interest up. But yeah, it's all well-meaning, and it just goes to that fundamental thing. People really love the Sydney Harbour Bridge. They want to hear a good story about it.
Well, the media plays a very good role. They can be our allies sometimes, and they can certainly be our enemy at other times. In this particular case, they weren't helpful in a lot of regards, one of which was about the numbers of people that were actually being invited to go to the event. The media were asking questions like, oh, so everybody's registered and they don't have a ticket, but they've got a confirmation form. So what are they got to do when they get to North Sydney or Milsons Point? Who checks them? And, of course, the honest answer is, well, no one was going to check them. Oh, so anyone could really turn up. The media kept pressing, and then, in fact, some of the radio jocks, the shock jocks, were there saying, oh, well, you're going to have a lot of people turn up. In fact, everybody out there, if you're listening to me, you can turn up. You don't have to register anyway, which, of course, caused us great concern.
On radio commentary earlier during the week, we were a little bit apprehensive my husband wouldn't come today because he said, no, it's going to be debacle.
Catherine Parker recollects.
I think there was probably a moment of consternation where all government departments, not just the RTA, were concerned that if too many people showed up, we actually in the time frame could not walk 400,000 across the bridge. It would take 2 days to do that. We also couldn't get them in and out of the city on the public transport. We would have had to put even more trains and buses on. But then it became apparent from the way people were responding that most people who actually wanted to attend had registered anyway. It wasn't going to be a blowout.
The ability to move thousands of people safely to and from the event by public transport was always going to be the big challenge. Majid El-Khatib was in charge of organising rail transport for the event.
We put on something like close to 527 additional services, which in theory, you know, it's quite a fair bit, you know, to sustain a train timetable and keep it running and keep the dwell time there going over the bridge, you know, constant throughout the day was an achievement in itself.
Now, how do you load all those people onto a train every 5 to 10 minutes when you have wheelchairs, you have prams? What did you do about all that?
We had an issue at Milsons Point. I mean, I still recall the moment when I went to Milsons Point and had a look at the lift and jumped in the lift, and the lift cycle itself took about 2.5 minutes to go from the platform to the concourse and return, and could only fit a wheelchair and possibly a pram. So there was an issue there. So we ended up having a couple of additional staff, and when I say a couple, it was more like 10 additional staff at Milsons Point, North Sydney, solely dedicated to assist people with pram. And that was a huge success to us clearing the stations and the platforms, allowing the next train to come along.
So how many people do you estimate you've moved for the event on that day?
We counted in excess of about 160,000 people.
Bus timetables also had to be changed to cater for increased demand. Raymond Carroll is the State Transit Authority's Special Events Coordinator.
Initially, our main thinking was the relocation of bus terminals. All the buses that do use the Sydney Harbour Bridge can't use the Sydney Harbour Bridge, and it's not advised that we use the Sydney Harbour Tunnel either, because that would be gridlocked with a lot of traffic. So our main planning initially is where to relocate our buses, where the best spot is for people to get off the bus and to rejoin their bus. And also, we've got to also maintain a link with North Sydney and the train station. So there's a number of factors that we've got to consider.
Now, tell me, what effect did the two queens, the Queen Elizabeth II and the Queen Mary II, both being in the city just weeks before, have on the Sydney Harbour Bridge event? Did it have any particular influence on it?
Yes, I think it escalated the importance of the event. And basically, we're told not to stuff it up. Additional special event clearways went in throughout the Sydney road network. So a lot more measures were put into place to ensure that the event would run smoothly and traffic wouldn't be as bad as it was on this particular day. On top of our normal Sunday timetable, over the network we provided an extra 1,400 trips. That's in all areas of the city. And mainly those additional trips operated between the hours of 8:30 a.m. and 9:30 p.m.
Later in the morning, the Premier, Morris Yama, unveiled a plaque to the 16 workers killed during the bridge's construction.
Our bridge is a much-loved icon, but let's never forget that it was built at a heavy cost, in lives lost and shattered families. 16 Australian workers lost their lives building the bridge. Every one of those 16 deaths was a tragedy. One worker was a 54-year-old dogman, knocked off a punt by a load of steel at Milsons Point. Another died of tetanus after injuring his thumb. A 25-year-old iron worker fell from the arch of the bridge when his spanner slipped. William Wood was killed in an accident off the western approaches. Alexander Faulkner was struck by a metal part falling from a crane. Let's never forget our debt to them and to their fellow workers. They did not die in vain. I'd now like to invite the grandchildren of Alexander Faulkner and William Wood to come forward and join me as I unveil this plaque, to be erected in the memory of the men who lost their lives building one of the great icons of the world, our bridge.
Also walking the bridge was the Honourable Malcolm Turnbull MP, Federal Minister for the Environment and Water Resources.
I'm very excited to be here today with hundreds of thousands of other Australians and Sydneysiders. It's a wonderful day. The bridge has been a part of the life of this history. It's really framed the city for 75 years. All of us have our own special memories of the bridge. I was particularly pleased earlier today to announce that we are placing the bridge on the National Heritage List. So that's a very important recognition of the bridge's cultural and historical importance for Sydney and, of course, for all of Australia. It's one of the great icons of Australia. The bridge, if the bridge were to be built today, it would be an awesome feat. But to imagine it in a city with no skyscrapers, with no opera house, with no jets flying overhead, a city of a completely different scale, a fraction of the size, this must have seemed even more remarkable, much more remarkable than it is today.
So what sort of a statement do you think it makes for Sydney?
Oh, I think this bridge is all about Sydney. It's really saying welcome, isn't it? It's an open gate.
We walked it because we're going to be 75 ourselves this year. And we came down from Foster in northern New South Wales to walk across the bridge for our 75th birthday.
I walked across on the first day with my father, whose photograph I have here. And so today my family have brought me across. And it's been a very interesting and a very emotional experience.
And what do you think you'll bring back from today?
Well, I won't see the 100th, but my great-granddaughter there in the pusher has had her photograph taken with me today. So on the 100th anniversary, perhaps she'll walk across and remember that she walked across when she was a few months old with her great-grandmother.
And what does it mean for you, the bridge? What does it represent to you?
It represented, as a child, the opening of a country that has become probably the best country in the world still. And let's hope that with a little more honesty in our politics and a little more heart in our politicians, we can keep it that way.
When I first walked across a bridge, I lived in Balmain.
How old were you when you first walked across the bridge?
8 years old.
What do you remember about that day?
Raining. It was raining and all the schools were there, but we didn't care. We got wet, and so I was determined nothing was going to stop me from walking today. And I'm very emotional. Now that I've reached 84, and I thought, there's nothing going to stop me from walking that bridge. All my other friends are sitting by television and watching it over TV, but I said, no way, I'm walking.
I walked over here 2 days before the bridge was opened, as a schoolboy, aged 10. I came as a representative of Canterbury Public School. After we walked across the bridge, we then went to the showground. The girls did maypole dancing and the boys did flag drill. And then we had a couple of days off without trouble. It was a good day. It's very nice to be here too today.
What does the bridge mean to you?
History. History, very much, and it'll be here for another 400 years, I believe.
You know why? I'm nearly 83, and I'm walking along here because my father helped Bradfield build the bridge. He made all the rockers, the steel rockers, that held the cables on the bridge. You know, this bridge at the bottom that has four large rockers, well, they were too big for here. But all the little ones down in the tunnels at Wynyard and on the other side that held the cables that held the bridge up until it was joined were on the rockers that my daddy made. Now, I hear everybody at the moment talking about their grandfathers and what they did, but that was my father. So that's a long time ago.
Do you have any memories of the bridge, madam?
Yes, I walked over here when it was opened, and I'm walking over it again. So how about that?
How old were you actually when you walked across for the first time?
I was only little, but I could walk, and I'm 83. And my father worked on this bridge, and I used to come over from the other side because we lived over there at North Sydney, and we used to come over on the ferry, and we used to look up and see him on scaffolding working on the bridge. So it's a lot to think about, isn't it?
I was right up at the front when de Groot cut the ribbon, and my father took me home, tried to explain as best you can to a little girl about the problems between monarchy and politicians and so on.
My grandmother was pregnant with my mother when she walked over it years ago.
She fainted on the bridge, so that's how she found out she was pregnant. She realised she was pregnant when she fainted on the bridge.
So we've come today for a good walk with the grandkids.
What does it mean to you to be here today?
It's a real Australian pride thing, I think. It's all Australia. It's not just Sydney or New South Wales. Our family, my children's family, came out in the first fleet. So this is it here.
Very proud.
Really proud.
For an event of this scale to run smoothly, the planning meetings canvassed many risk management scenarios. Rachel Herford recalls.
Internally within the project, we had a system of identifying potential risks, documenting them, and then determining, okay, what are the things we can do to minimise that or make it go away? And then at a government level across all of those agencies, we held a session which we refer to as a tabletop exercise or a tabletop planning scenario, where essentially we sat around a room, we were grouped by agency, we were led by a facilitator who developed a series of scenarios, which I was actually more involved in. Most other people were people were able to contribute ideas from all the different agencies, but then what ended up being put together was, I guess, a secret for the day. And essentially, I think it ran over about 3 or 4 hours. And we started at the beginning of the day, and Barry, the facilitator, would throw something at us. Okay, it's 7:30 a.m. and the Bureau of Meteorology has just issued a severe storm warning with thunder, da da da. What are you doing about it? How do you do it? We'd work around the table. Now, that exercise tested everything from trains breaking down on the bridge to a protest march that interrupted movement to the stage for our official ceremony not being able to be taken away and blocking the walk. A fire in North Sydney, which meant the North Sydney station had to be closed. So a whole range of scenarios, which everyone around the table then contributed to and answered. That session identified to the group if there were any gaps within planning or if there was any discrepancy in who was responsible for which bit or who communicated to who about what, and really tested us. And then we all came back together a week later, I guess, to debrief and to check off and to report in as to what we'd done since then to improve or fill in the gaps.
Bill Lawson comments.
In designing any event, we always have a contingency because we really don't know what's going to be served at us. But unfortunately, at just before 2 p.m. on that Sunday afternoon, the 18th of March, somebody decided to commit suicide at North Sydney Station. And that, of course, disrupted train services, presented a huge problem in terms of the delivery of people to North Sydney Station, where we had to actually then marshal most of them to Milsons Point Station. Police were on the scene very quickly. The situation was able to be recovered fairly quickly. It's a shame that it happened, and it's a shame for the person concerned, of course.
There were to be no further incidents, and as day turned to night, the crowd was treated to a new spectacle. Noel Staunton elaborates.
The lighting was very important. In all the history of the bridge's lighting, it's always been lit from the outside in, and we wanted to light it from the inside out. And in this process, I decided not to have one lighting designer, but to have three. So we had a theatre lighting designer, a rock and roll lighting designer, and an architectural lighting designer. And the idea, my view was, with these three disciplines, we'd get a bit of beauty, a bit of movement, and a bit of structure, and show the bridge in its totality, not just lighting between the pylons, but lighting between the two landmasses on either side.
We ran 5 kilometres, perhaps it was more, of fluorescent tubing along the edge of the road deck on both the east and west, so that when you looked at the bridge, rather than it starting and stopping at the pylons, you got a real sense of it joining the north and the south, and that roadway connected much further into those cities.
Then the public saw the full stretch of the bridge rather than just between the pylons. So that when you were on the bridge at night, it looked very different than it's ever looked before. We also decided to do a smoking ceremony on the bridge because we felt the Aborigines that lived around the bridge at the time, there were two important communities there. So we engaged Stephen Page, the artistic director of Bangara Dance Company. And we worked with him to find a big smoking ceremony. And we put 90 drums on the bridge and filled them with the eucalyptus in a particular way. And they gave off a whole lot of beautiful smoke. And we gave all the members of the public caps with lights on. So if you imagine a picture of a sea of lights and smoke, smelling of eucalyptus, and a fantastic soundscape of Aboriginal music composed by David Page, Stephen's brother. It was the most magical moment on the bridge, and I will never forget that as long as I live.
Volunteers as an element in the whole process?
I think very important. I think, one, there's an expectation that there'll be volunteers associated with an event in this city after the Olympics, and how important volunteers were to the delivery and success of the Games in 2000. They give an event of this nature a human face. You know, from the moment someone stepped off a train or a bus through to walking across the bridge, along the way there are volunteers that are interacting, are chatting, or are just simply there, but they become the event. They handed out hats, they gave directions, they cheered people along. They had a great time themselves. Lots of really wonderful feedback from them and thank yous and the best thing I've ever done. And they get their T-shirt and their backpack and a lunch pack, and that's all sort of exciting. And, yeah, look, I think for those who participate, it's a nice, warm, personal touch to things.
What surprised me about the event is how passionate people felt about the bridge and how many people connected to it in their ordinary lives. That was really fascinating.
Dennis Wheeler.
My enduring memories of the Harbour Bridge event will certainly be the thousands of smiling and happy faces, both from small children right up to adults. Didn't matter where you went, what you were doing on the day, where I was working, there was always people stopping, taking photos, people asking you to take photos of them again from a different angle, people waving at you. No, it was a great day.
So on a scale out of 10, how would you rate this event?
I would rate this event, it'd have to be up right up near the top. I think we rate it 10 out of 10, that one.
It was the most fantastic sort of climax conclusion in a way to all of the work that we had done for the Bridge exhibition and the Bridge publication. So to feel that our project had contributed towards a much more major outpouring of association and feeling and experience with the Bridge was really fantastic.
The best part for me, I think, was at about 10 o'clock at night when it was all over, and I went back and just thought, yes, is it surreal? Has the day gone through? We just started to sprinkle a bit, a bit of rain coming down. And no, it was great. It was great to reflect on one long day.
Bill Lawson.
It's certainly got a presence. And in particular, too, of a night when the lighting's on the bridge seems to come alive as well. So it's a day bridge, it's a night bridge. It seems to have some, add some strength to the city.
It's a bridge for all seasons.
a bridge for all seasons and all events.
Now, if you had to organise or oversee another event like this again, what would you do differently next time?
I would actually have a greater control over the website answers and questions. I'd have a number of opportunities for people to say where their friends are actually coming from, because we were able to only assume that they were in the same or adjacent postcodes. So there was a lot of assumptions made in terms of the transport corridor and what we would need to do to satisfy the demands. So I'd have more extensive questions with regard to that, the registration of participants for the day.
Dennis Wheeler.
Probably try and start a little bit earlier. Lock the creative people away after they've had their first ideas and say, that's it, they're set in concrete now. That certainly would be a nice practical thought, but I realise that it doesn't happen that way.
Catherine Parker. I think from the RTA's point of view, we would get ourselves internally better coordinated right from the start, because it was sort of like a progressive getting to know that other people were in fact involved in this event. We're all from different directorates, and I think that that internal coordination, we should have made that happen much sooner. But being involved in the whole event was extremely satisfying, but also just exciting to be involved in an event that was a moment in history and will stay a moment in history.
Rachel Herford offers this perspective. I'd have a holiday before it all started. Not a great deal other than have a little bit more time, really, and not losing sight of the big picture. If it's lessons for the next time something happens about the bridge, would be don't underestimate the connection and the emotion attached to the Sydney Harbour Bridge by the community. Like, there are many, many people out there who just feel such a special sort of connection to it or have a warmth to it for some obscure reason, and they come out in droves and they want to be involved. And that's certainly a lesson for next time, not to underestimate that. Look, from a government perspective, I think the lesson was just it's coordination, it's communication, it's that one agency can't do this on their own, that everyone has to come together. And then I think from a creative point of view, you can be bold, like think big, think bold.
People get a bit overawed by the size of the bridge when they realise just how big it is.
I always feel a bit sorry for the people who work at the Opera House, actually, for the opposite reason. Everyone talks about the bridge and the Opera House, but I think when you get out of your car and you actually stand on the side of the footpath on the bridge, you realise that as gorgeous as the Opera House is, it really is tiny compared to the mammoth Sydney Harbour Bridge. It just blows you away, particularly when you talk about the 75th birthday and you think, well, it was, you know, 80-odd years before that they drew up those drawings. Sitting down by hand and working out the calculations to build something of that size, it is quite an awe-inspiring kind of a thing, and it's still dramatic in every sense.
To end this oral history, the last word is from Charles Traill, who walked the bridge.
Tommy Soldier and Aussie were walking down George Street or whatever, and the Yank said, you know, he said, it took us 6 months just to build a White House. And the Pommy said, oh, that's nothing. He said, Buckingham Palace only took 3 months. And they turned the corner and they saw the bridge. And they said, the Aussie, what's that? He said, I know, mate, wasn't here this morning.
The opinions expressed in the oral history interviews are those of the individuals concerned, and do not necessarily represent in whole or in part the position of the New South Wales Government and its agencies.